Welcome to the Kingdom Crossroads Podcast with Pastor Robert Thibodeau. Using an interview format, Pastor Bob will introduce you to men and women whose ministries are impacting this world with the gospel, and will also provide commentary and insight on end-time prophetic events we now see happening in the news. Now here is Pastor Robert Thibodeau.
Hello, everyone, everywhere. This is Pastor Robert Thibodeau. Welcome to the Kingdom Crossroads Podcast today. You know, with this COVID-19 crisis going on right now, people have a lot of questions. And we are reaching out to the experts in this area so that you're not going into this blind and listening to rumors. Dr. Dan O'Brien is a physician and a professor with a passion for innovative healthcare technologies and public health, and he's a popular medical expert with appearances on all sorts of national talk shows, including Fox Television, an award-winning scientific and academic leader. Dr. Dan has worked with several biotech and pharmaceutical companies on increasing awareness, education, and research in many different fields, including biotech industry. Dr. Dan has an extensive physicians network, including relationships with key opinion leaders around the world, and he's completed his clinical rotations at Emory University at Atlanta, Georgia, and completed a certificate of participation from Johns Hopkins School of Medicine from right here in Baltimore, Maryland. He has an MBA in health management, MBA from the University of Notre Dame, and more. And not only is he a medical expert for the here and now, he's also what's called a medical futurist with specialized knowledge in telemedicine, digital health, robotic technology, gene editing, you name it. So he's joining us today to talk about this COVID-19 crisis and some of the medical aspects and possible origins. Dr. Dan O'Brien, thank you for joining us today. I appreciate your time coming on the program.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you for having me.
Now, right now, the big news is all this diagnostic testing. And although the information appears as if there's, you know, a number of tests being administered, in actuality, how many tests do we actually need to have to test over 300 million people and make sure that this thing's under control?
No, great question. We certainly need a lot of tests, right, as we test people, you know, kind of on a weekly basis. And kind of where testing is headed is there's a lot what's called an antibody serology test, which is a point-of-care test, which allows results to be done in 15 or 20 minutes. And also, too, there's this at-home diagnostic kit that's actually going to be possibly sent to someone's home, and then you send that off to the lab. It's almost, you know, similar to getting kind of like a nasal swab and then kind of going from there. So it's really interesting. We're certainly going to need, with that population that you mentioned, a great deal of diagnostic tests to be able to pick up, you know, some cases that are maybe symptomatic or even asymptomatic.
Yeah, and a person just can't be tested once and say, okay, I'm good. I mean, a test today that's negative, that person may be exposed next week and a couple weeks later come down with symptoms. So how often will people have to actually be tested for this?
You make an interesting point because really it's so crucial to get many different data points to be able to pick up trends and patterns to be able to make informed decisions. So to answer your question, I would think, you know, possibly on a weekly or maybe biweekly stance to be able to be tested. So I think that's where the reliability and the accuracy and the precision of diagnostic testing is going to be so crucial. So it's just until we kind of get a vaccine, which is probably, you know, realistically maybe 12 to 18 months away, you know, at minimum, I think there has to be continued diagnostic testing.
Wow. That means if we just did it, well, you're talking over a billion tests. Do we have even anywhere near the capability of producing that many tests?
It's really a great deal.
As far as the test kits?
Right. I think that's where, you know, right now medical companies are certainly pivoting. I think the diagnostic companies are kind of pivoting in the direction of this unmet need of how we're going to help so many people. And I think as we gather scientific literature and the data, this is where clinical validation comes is very crucial to make sure that we have the right diagnostic test that we're giving individuals, and also just we have the wherewithal to be able to supply that many diagnostic tests. So I think that's where they're kind of figuring things out, and as we look to the future, there's going to have to be a robust performance on behalf of the diagnostic companies.
Wow. Yeah. Now, you mentioned the availability of home tests and all that. It's like a pregnancy test kit. You could just go down to the drugstore and get it and take it home and swab your nose or whatever and send it in? Is that how it is? Or will you be able to, you know, get the plus or minus sign right there in your bathroom?
Right. There's kind of two theories. There's one, we have to send it off to a lab. You kind of get a swab. But also this, what's known as this colorimetric, what you see, to your point in regards to pregnancy test, you could have a, you know, different color showing up, whether or not you would be positive or negative. And I think this is where, you know, looking at a biostatistical standpoint, having this high negative predictive value within a test, which means you have a great chance of a rule out. So say a test has a 95% high negative predictive value, you know, you can feel comfortable and have a peace of mind that you know you're ruling out whether or not you have COVID-19 or not. So I think this is where this clinical validation, as you're looking at safety and efficacy and as you're studying sample populations, is so crucial to be on the right side of science as we find the right diagnostic test.
Yeah, amen. Amen. You know, I understand this virus is more contagious than the normal flu, but yet, you know, I've seen the statistics that says the normal flu kills more people annually than we've seen die from this virus, but yet we've never shut down the entire country or the world for that matter over just the flu. I mean, why is this situation different?
Speed is everything, you know, with COVID, and as far as just how fast this is contagious, that's the big difference between the flu. You know, with the flu, we have hundreds of years of data going back even to the birth of modern medicine. But with COVID-19, we only have a few months data. So I think this is where capturing the right amount of data and how much we're learning every day is just so crucial in this process.
Amen. Amen. Is it true that having, you know, I haven't had it, thank God, but is it true having the coronavirus is similar to someone visiting a high altitude and getting winded, like someone who lives near sea level and then decides to go to the Colorado mountains and go hiking?
There actually has been an interesting correlation that I know one of the physicians was talking about in regards to some of the same symptoms, right? That shortness of breath, that congestion of your lungs. And this is where maybe that medication, zeolizolamide, could play a role in possible treatment. So there is this high altitude sickness as you're kind of in, you know, respiratory alkalosis, and how that correlation is made to some of the symptoms of COVID-19. It's very interesting. I think as the data is going to show, we're going to learn a lot more in the upcoming months.
Amen. So this medicine that you just mentioned, how does that treat that condition?
Right. So zeolizolamide, that really just helps a lot with, if you look at even the oxygen levels and making sure people's numbers are kind of in line. So there's a lot of treatment for this kind of what's known as respiratory alkalosis that you get in regards to being at a high altitude. And I think, obviously, if we look at treatments with COVID, it's going to be an interesting correlation to see if that would work. Even some of the blood pressure medications you can use to treat high altitude sickness. And would that be used to treat COVID? And I think, again, this is where the research, when we look at treatments, is going to be so crucial, as we have right now, everything I think is on the table. And it's important to look at all aspects.
I mean, I've seen a report that a lot of patients who have died from this virus, they have blood clots, and that that people that are on blood thinners may be more able to endure it, I guess you could say. What about blood clots? How does, you know, what does all that involve concerning COVID-19?
Sure, absolutely. Just kind of that, you know, that buildup, that congestion that you see, you know, potentially in the lungs, that if you have a clot, you know, same thing as you're kind of traveling, right, and you remain kind of stasis, you kind of have that ability to develop a clot. And right now, how COVID affects the lungs, I think that's where you look at a lot of the pathophysiology of looking at blood clots.
So people, like my wife has had a stroke, so she's on Plavix and all that. So she would be more able to withstand the virus than someone like I've never had a stroke, so I'm not on the stuff. So I would be more susceptible to succumbing to it.
Yes, absolutely. I think this is where the research, I think still is, you know, still we're still finding more about this. And I think it's just going to be crucial as scientists make these various connections to all these disease states. And of course, you have to be mindful of those that are immune compromised over the age of 65 and have pre-existing conditions. I think that's where a lot of the focus still has to remain.
Amen. Amen. Let's shift gears here for a minute. I recently seen a Newsweek article that claims, you know, the front man for the White House task force, Dr. Fauci himself, may be partly responsible for the research that was conducted at the Wuhan lab. And, you know, that's under, you know, accusations right now for having been the birthplace of the virus. Have you heard anything about that, that he was help funding that lab?
Yes, you know, there was a story talking about that the U.S. funded, you know, was $7.4 million over to China in regards to this study of virology, which looks at gain-of-function research kind of on how pandemics actually start. So we actually provided a lot of the funding, and this is where it's crucial that we have funding in the U.S., that we keep maybe some of our research dollars with scientists and researchers here instead of other countries. So it's really pivotal that we have better control of our key infrastructure elements here in the U.S.
Amen. So it wasn't really like Dr. Fauci sending money over there. It was just the CDC or whatever was, you know, doling out money for different research going on around the world.
Right. So he's part of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases. Okay. And it's, you know, it's very common for institutions like that to be able to send money away in regards to research projects. It's just very interesting to know, as we were looking at the study of virology, how, again, we funded the lab over there. And maybe, again, you know, looking to the future, we could possibly keep those dollars here in the U.S. for research here instead of over in China.
Okay. Yeah, we've heard different versions of, you know, what may have happened in the lab in China. You know, either contamination occurred and one person walked out and went had lunch at that wet market, or, you know, there's a bat that got contaminated or something like that. Now that we've had a little bit more time to look at this, what are your sources saying about the source of the origin of this virus?
Right, a lot of research, right, on that, and I think it's still kind of ongoing. And I think that obviously with the connection with the bat, you know, there in the lab, and I think it was a lot of things had gotten mishandled there at the laboratory, and then from there, you know, things had certainly spread. So I think with the complexity of our bodies and the immune system and immunology, that this wasn't man-made, but again, this was something that research was going on at the lab, and usually labs are very controlled environments. That somehow things had got a maybe there was a lot of, you know, chaos within the lab and not very well handled. And again, I think things had spread and got out of control from there. And interesting, they were doing this study on looking at biology and looking at kind of, protein sequencing and kind of how viruses, you know, spread. And it was very interesting research that they were doing at the time. And sure enough, everything kind of let out. And here we are.
Wow. Yeah. And, you know, China is being accused of, you know, not cooperating fully with the investigations and in the initial stages and all that. And, you know, I can understand, you know, them wanting to contain the bad news. But at the same time, it seems like they should have at least been talking to their peers about, you know, what is happening and how quickly it's spreading. You know, what do your sources say about all that?
Yes, exactly. I think this is where we have to be careful who we trust, and we have to continue to pursue the truth with scientific data, and we have to look after humanity in the right way. You know, we actually, the U.S. sent over PPEs there in China, and they're hoarding billions of masks, and obviously, you know, selling it as well. So we really have to be mindful of, here as a country, who we're trusting, and again, pursuing the truth in regards to accurate information.
Amen. Let's talk about the social distancing plans that have been implemented. You know, I know the push has been on, you know, quote unquote, flattening the curve, which was really designed just to stop a possible overrun or overwhelming situation in the hospitals. But doesn't flattening the curve simply lengthen the time the virus can actually impact the nation? I mean, that was the reason for social distancing and stay-at-home orders and shutting down everything, was to flatten the curve so that the hospitals didn't get overrun, right?
Yes, exactly. Where we kind of got that from was the Spanish flu back in 1918, where they were actually practicing social distancing as well as wearing masks. So this is where we learned a lot of those kind of various, you know, rules to be able to do those things. And they're saying, obviously, social distancing, the way it's spreading and seems to be working. But as we increase the diagnostic testing, it's going to be interesting. We may see an increase in cases, because now you have asymptomatic, you know, people potentially being tested and, you know, turning positive for COVID. So we really have to be mindful as we're picking up the geographical trends and patterns of where COVID is actually hitting, to make sure, again, we have public health policies in place.
Amen. Yeah, the plan now, it seems, is, you know, that they're, even though social distancing is in place, it still seems like people are still getting the virus, You know, even though, I mean, some people have been said they haven't gone out at all, and yet they still ended up with a virus. I mean, how is that even possible?
Right. You know, certainly interesting. And it's, of course, we know that, you know, how it's kind of spread. And if there's anyone that in the family that has stepped outside, unless, you know, again, somehow their bodies were immune compromised and they're able to kind of pick it up, or maybe they had it before. Maybe they had it kind of late 2019 and didn't realize that they had it. Even though they were practicing social distancing, they may have had it before those rules were actually in place.
Wow. Yeah. I know a friend of mine, I'm a retired police officer, and one of my officers that used to work for me, his daughter, this was in, I want to say, mid-January, came down with the flu, and within 3 days had passed away. And it took everybody by surprise. And, you know, now looking back, they're thinking that she had that virus because, you know, she just had the flu and said, let me go lay down. I'm just going to go to sleep type thing. And that was it. You know, so you're saying this just didn't come around in February. It was possibly in the United States back in as early as January?
Yes, exactly, where people had it, and maybe they didn't realize that they had it. So, again, they couldn't get treatment fast enough. And really, with COVID, speed was everything, just how contagious this is compared to the flu. And I think that's where just being prepared, you know, as a healthcare provider and learning more about how healthcare systems are really preparing is just so crucial during this time.
Yeah, amen. Yeah, I've seen some discussion about, you know, instead of having everyone be socially isolated, you need to let them get out and get exposed to it so we can build up, you know, what they call the herd immunity. What's your thoughts on that?
Yeah, you know, it's certainly an interesting theory. And I think right now it's just, you know, where is the data? Where is the research in regards to, is that actually, you know, working, getting the population kind of exposed? So I think as we learn more, you know, especially as we look at the next couple months, I mean, I just think how much we've learned since the beginning of March with all this.
Yeah.
I think as we look to the future in the upcoming weeks, we're going to continue to learn more about, is herd immunity a good thing, or, you know, should we be looking at other alternative methods as well?
Well, isn't that what the vaccine would do? Is you're actually introducing it into the population and their own body? It's just in that small dose, and your body will build up the immunity to it?
Exactly. You're 100% correct. And what's interesting about the vaccine, this would be able to prevent COVID, whereas, again, these antivirals treat the symptoms.
Well, I remember seeing a report, and I think it was on the news just a few days ago, that said the virus is mutating faster than the normal virus does. And you know, I mean, the CDC comes out every year with the flu shot they think will be the strain that becomes dominant each fall. If this coronavirus mutates faster than normal, I mean, how can they develop a vaccine that can stay ahead of the mutations?
Exactly. You know, you're 100% correct. And, you know, research has shown there could be between 3 to 8 strains. If we look at New York,
wow,
that strain could be from Europe. Or if we look to, say, California, maybe that strain came from China. And as we look, you know, further into research in terms of kids getting COVID, that could be a potentially different strain as well. So I think this is where just understanding, being on the right side of science with the data and collecting reliable information is so crucial as we learn more.
Amen. Now, you're a medical futurist. How is the medical community using artificial intelligence to advance healthcare, especially in the era of the coronavirus right now?
Well, it's interesting. As we're sorting through the data, you know, kind of talking about the data, AI allows the data to be organized in a very systematic fashion. You know, physicians and nurses, they're kind of looking for a needle in a haystack as they're looking through their labs of COVID-19 patients. So what AI could do is kind of simplify that to be able to plug in certain things into an algorithm. So let's just say we have, you know, Jane Doe as a patient. We're able to look at through AI, maybe, you know, Jane's immunology, maybe her genes, maybe her symptoms. So you plug that into a machine algorithm, you know, sort of formula, and that would spit out an accurate diagnosis. And essentially it would just be an additional tool for clinicians to be able to utilize on whether or not how we should triage into possibly low, medium, or high-risk patients. So AI is not going to replace the healthcare workers, but again, be a supplemental, additional clinical tool to be able to help sort through the data and make more informed decisions.
Wow. So it's, you know, back in the old days, they'd use a spreadsheet. It's just basically zipping through all these different spreadsheets and then saying, hey, we're seeing a trend here.
Exactly. And really, if you look at the human body, it's so complex. It's almost like a spaceship, right? When we look at AI, it's just composed of many different systems. And if we have a system through AI to kind of simplify that, to verify again, would this be an accurate diagnosis? And then a treatment plan, it's going to be really interesting as we look at augmenting, you know, to make more effective, essentially, the data through the use of AI. And again, not to replace healthcare workers, but as an additional clinical tool to help.
Amen. Now, since we're talking about future technology and all that, what else is coming down the tubes that is going to advance healthcare in the near future?
Sure. I certainly think now that digital apps, you know, looking at remote monitoring, you know, say again, someone has, you know, a high blood pressure or diabetes. I think that's going to be, you know, so crucial with this remote monitoring that possibly through the use of telemedicine is crucial. Again, looking at this virtual visit between a physician and patient through this remote monitoring, I really think is the future as we look to the next 8 or 9 months. You know, about 95% of my MD colleagues are utilizing telemedicine to be able to communicate to increase the access to patients, particularly for these non-urgent cases as well.
Yeah, amen. I know, you know, we've had several doctor's appointments that have been set up, you know, where instead of going in, they called us up, say, hey, you're going to be on the computer now, you know, type thing. But, you know, well, I'm good with that because, you know, I don't want to go and sit in the waiting room with, you know, 35 people. Right now. So that's awesome. Well,
exactly.
As we get ready to close, I want to thank you for being on the front lines fighting this pandemic. You know, if someone wanted to get in touch with you to ask a question or possibly do an interview like this, how can they do that? How can they get in touch with you?
Yes, my website is drdanmd.com.
All right, drdanmd.com. I'll put that down in the show notes. All right. And again, thank you for coming on the program. Folks, we know this pandemic is, you know, hopefully just a once in a 100-year event that seems to plague humanity. But unlike past events, this one has the advantage of having technology on our side. And medical personnel like Dr. Dan O'Brien, who are looking at what the future of medicine will need and how it's developing on our frontline defense in this war, as President Trump calls it, the unseen enemy. He's one of the frontline troops out there tackling this problem. And as he says, just in the past month or so, we have learned so much about this. So go down the show notes, get in touch with Dr. Dan today. Dr. Dan, thank you again for coming on the program. I do appreciate your time.
Yes, thank you so much for having me on, and always glad to be on anytime.
Amen. Folks, that is all the time we have for today. For Dr. Dan O'Brien, myself, this is Pastor Bob reminding you, be blessed in all that you do. Are you a Christian entrepreneur, coach, or author with a message that needs to be heard? Picture this, your voice reaching thousands, your story inspiring hearts, and your business flourishing like never before. Introducing Faithcasters, the ultimate platform that connects faith-driven professionals like you with the power of podcasting. Become a sought-after guest on Faith-Based Podcast. Share your unique insights and connect with like-minded individuals who share your passion for faith and entrepreneurship as well. Imagine your expertise reaching a wider audience, expanding your network, and propelling your business to new heights. Well, it's all within reach with Faithcasters. So don't wait. Take the first step today on your journey to greatness by visiting our website at faithcaster.org. That's faithcaster.org. Join the Faithcasters community now and unleash the full potential of your faith-driven enterprise. You do not want to miss this opportunity. Faithcasters, where faith meets podcasting and your dreams become reality. Visit faithcaster.org Let's soar together. And remember, anyone can be a podcaster, but only a Christian can become a faithcaster. Faithcasters, your voice, your platform, your success.